Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today I'm playing the second half of the interview I did with Duncan Lamont. And this is the first interview in a series of interviews that I'm replaying, the most remarkable ones I have done in the last few years. So hang on, here come the show. If you were listening last week, you heard me say that for the next, I think it's 7 or 8 weeks now, I am rerunning some of the most remarkable interviews that I have done over the last few years, and that they are remarkable not only for the talent of the people that I'm interviewing, but for the amazing way in which they found their work, their art, their creativity, the thing from which they made their life. My show is all about becoming who you really are. And some people, like the people in the interviews I'm doing for the next few weeks, are people who didn't find it because they went looking for it. It came looking for them in the most serendipitous and haphazard and ironic ways. And as I said last week, this is the second half of the interview I did with Duncan Lamont, whose entire life has been dedicated to every possible variation there is for making music. So as I said last week, it feels very much as though life just picked Duncan up by the scruff of the neck and said, no, this is what you're going to do. You're not going to continue to work in the mines, which is what he started out thinking he was going to have to do. So in the middle of this interview, I take breaks to play some of the songs that Duncan wrote. There's no way to name the unending list of people who he has played with, who he's written songs for, who have recorded his songs, who have awarded him, applauded him, the awards that he's won. There's just no way to do that. He'll mention a little of that in his really self-deprecating way. But we'll let Duncan speak for himself. He's certainly eminently capable of doing that. And so here, the sweet funny, extraordinarily talented, generous, and dear Duncan Lamont.
Then I got involved in songs, strangely enough, writing songs. And because there was a singer, I used to do a lot of broadcasts with a quintet, wonderful, great quintet, and a great singer called Sandra King, just lovely singer. Anyway, Sandra used to say to me, she'd phone me the night before, she'd say, "Duncan, write a song for tomorrow's broadcast." So I used to write a song. And
it's like whatever they asked you to do.
Yeah.
It's like you never got it that you couldn't do it.
That's right, yeah. That's true, yeah. But I mean, Sandra used to say, write a song. And I wrote a song called, what's the title? I Told You So. I Told You So. And it so happened that at that time I'd been in Los Angeles, and I met Matt Dennis. Matt wrote Angel Eyes and Let's Get Away From It All and The Night We Called It Day. Wonderful songs. Mm-hmm. And Everything Happens to Me. And Bridget and I got lost. We went to a friend's for dinner and we got lost. And we're driving around those nightmare, motorways in LA. And I saw a sign that said Dante's or whatever, mm-hmm. Jazz Club. I said, "Why, it's a jazz club." And we drove in, and Matt Dennis was just finishing his act, and he did one more song, and then that was the end of the evening. So when he came up, I said to him, he walked past the table, I said, "I really admire your music very much." And he said, "Are you British?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you know John Dankworth and Cleo Lane?" Well, by that time, I'd worked so much with John and Cleo. And I said, "Yeah, of course." And he said, "Do you know Murray and Montgomery and Laurie Holloway, two other friends?" And so anyway, I said, he sat down at the table and I said, "Are you still writing, Matt?" He said, "Yeah, I just started again with my lyricist, Tom Adair." Tom wrote the lyric for Everything Happens to Me. Great, wonderful writer. And I said, "Well, I do some broadcasts. If you want to send me some songs, I'll do them on the broadcast." He said, "Great." So when I came back to Britain, there was a big sheaf of songs from Matt. So I did a couple of them. And I sent him I did a broadcast. And I sent him the tape of the broadcast. And he said, he phoned me, he said, "Duncan," he said, "really, that's nice. Thanks for doing the song." He said, "There was a song on that, an instrumental." He said, "I was wondering if you wrote it." And I said, "Is this in 3/4? I said, "Yeah, I did. I wrote it." He said, "Is it published?" I said, "No, it's unpublished." He said, "Well," he said, "I played it to Tom Adair, and Tom would like to do a lyric for it." I said, that's really thrilling, yeah. And because I know a lot about songs and songwriters, and as a matter of fact, I think I'm more of a songwriter than a saxophone player. But anyway, after 2 or 3 weeks, this big envelope came through the post, and it said "Silent Walls," it was called, by Duncan Lamont, and lyrics by Tom Adair. I was really thrilled. I took out and looked. I said, "That's great." And I looked at the lyric, and my heart sang. I thought, "I don't think it's a very good lyric."
Oh, dear.
It was just workmanlike, you know.
Yeah.
So I was doing a broadcast that evening, and I took the song along to Pat, who was Pat Smythe, the pianist. He was a wonderful player. And Sandra, I said, "What do you think of this, you know, this lyric, you know, this song?" And they both sort of shrugged and said, "Well, it's not bad. That's all we can say. It's not very thrilling. It's not bad." It was just a workmanlike lyric. So Pat said to me, "Duncan, why are you bothering about another lyric? Why don't you write lyrics yourself?" So I felt so embarrassed. I didn't want to phone Matt and say,
I don't like the lyric.
So I touched the subject and said, "Oh, Matt, really very thrilling, and it's great privilege." And I went through the thing actually without saying I liked the lyric. But what I started doing, because he said, "Look, have you got any?" He said, "I like your harmonic conception. If you got any other ones, you know, Tom would love to do them." So I started sending tunes to Matt with dummy lyrics that I'd written. And he said, "Matt, this is the sort of thing I think might be." But they were actually, the lyrics were finished. And then Tom, unfortunately, died of Alzheimer's. So I thought, well, I might as well write lyrics myself. So I started writing lyrics. And the first one I wrote was "I Told You So." And Pat Smythe, the pianist, was a very good friend of Blossom Dearie's. And he phoned me. Pat was dying of cancer, and he phoned me from the hospital. He said, "Duncan, I sent I Told You So to Blossom, and she's going to record it, you know." And Blossom was the first one to record it. And it just went on from there. Blossom asked me to send her some songs, and I sent them to her, and she recorded them. And
again, yet again.
Yeah. I've never
not
actually,
because you did anything.
I didn't do anything, no.
I didn't
do a thing. And I got a call once from LA, and a guy called Dick LaPam. And Dick knows everybody. He works for Steely Dan. He knew Hard Island, Duke Ellington. He was Nat Cole's best friend. He was the publicity manager from Nat Cole. And he knew Natalie very well. And he phoned me, introduced himself, and said, "You know, you wrote a song called I Told You So." He said, "I think Natalie would like it." He said, "She does not kick her." He said, "Kick her ass." And he said, "I think she would like it." So I just said, "Yeah.
Fine.
Why?" I can usual sort of thing. And then after a couple of weeks, he phoned me and said, "Natalie's recorded the song with a great rhythm section, Joe Sample and all the, you know, great guys in LA." But I just thought, I've heard it all before, you know. And I just thought, "Oh, that's wonderful." And then I was over here, and I got a call from Dick, and he said, "Have you got a couple of minutes to spare?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I want to play something." And he played Natalie's version of I Told You So, which was lovely. And Cleo also recorded a lot of songs of mine. Even it's funny talking about I Told You So, because I had a big band for 11 years for charity, for cancer research. I used to do it once a month. And there was this guy, a very good singer, who used to work with John Dankworth, called Frank Holder. And Frank phoned me, and he said, "Look," he said, "John and Cleo are doing a thing at the Barbican, one of the big halls, like sort of like the Albert Hall, but a modern hall. And they're doing the 40th anniversary or something of the big band, and they want me to sing. So can I borrow some of your arrangements?" And I said, "Yeah, help yourself, Frank." And I said, "Look, Frank," I said, "you've been so good," because he'd done it for years and years, you know, for nothing. And I said, "Look, I'll make you a little present. I don't want any money for copying or anything, but I'll do Foggy Day. I'll do the verse out of tempo. Then I'll bring it in with flugels and flutes." I said, "It'd be very pretty." I said, "Just a little present." And he said, "Oh, that sounds nice." I said, "Frank, you don't seem to be very pleased." He said, "Well," he said, "to be honest, Duncan, I'd rather do some of your songs." And I made this incredible statement. I said, "Frank, do yourself a favor. Don't do anything of mine." I said, "Look, Frank," I said, "if you go on and sing, say, a Foggy Day or any standard tune that people have grown up with, it's part of their psyche. I said, you'll really knock them out. I said, but if you go on and do songs I've never heard, I said, you'll die a death." He said, "Well, don't you think I do them well?" I said, "Frank, you do them beautifully." I said, "But that's my honest opinion." I said, "If you do anything of mine, you'll die a death." So I was out of town working, and I came back, and Frank phoned up. He said, "I did the gig." And he said, because eventually he said, "Well, I'd rather do something." I said, "Look, Frank, I'll tell you what, I'll still, I'll sit up all night, I'll do the arrangement for you, and you can take anything of mine, go to the rehearsal, and then see what John Cleo says, please yourself, I said, and do whatever you want. I said, do my songs if you want to. I said, but believe me, you'll die a death. Well, he said, I did Foggy Day, which was very nice. He said, it was really nice. And did a couple of other things. And then I did a couple of years, and John and Cleo said, do Duncan's songs. And Frank, who's rather vain, said, I knocked the audience out. He said, they really knocked out. I said, well, oh, that's really nice, Frank. I'm glad I was wrong. Well, about a week later, I got a call from John Dankworth, and he said, look, that song that Frank did was so beautiful. He said, Cleo's doing a recording in New York. He said, there were all sorts of people in it, like Toots Thielman, Jerry Mulligan, Clark Terry.
Oh, my God.
And he said, and she would really like to do that song, if it's okay with you. I said, yeah, of course it is, yeah. So he said, I'd get you to do the arrangement, Duncan, but I've finished it. I said, John, I don't want to do the arrangement. I said, all I want to is sit in the box like Hollywood without any pressures. I just went, sit there and hear it, and it'd be wonderful. You'd do a wonderful arrangement. He said, oh, great, fine. He said, well, can you write some additional lyrics? So I wrote some other lyrics for the second verse, because it was featuring... The album featured everybody on it, like Toots Thielman, mm-hmm. and Jerry Mulligan and Clark Terry. And there was a girl, a beautiful soprano saxophone player called Jane Ira Bloom, who was pretty well known. And it was featuring her. So he said, we need additional lyrics rather than the original lyrics. So I wrote some lyrics. And I turned up in New York, and John and Cleo, who are marvellous, marvellous people. And they said, let's go and have a meal. So I went to the meal, and John said to me, Duncan, yeah, that song of yours is really nice. And they'd arranged, John said to me, if you're coming to New York, we'll arrange so that we do your song on the day you're there. He said, we won't do it before or after you leave. I said, yeah, that's great. It's important. He said, we're going to do it on Tuesday. I said, oh, great. And this was Friday. He said, and Duncan, I think you should do the arrangement. I said, no, I don't want to do the arrangement, John. He said, no, I think you should do the arrangement. I said, John, look, I've never written for Cleo. I said, I don't know anything about her, you know. I said, musically, John, it'd be much better if you do it. He said, no, I think you should do it, Duncan. And this went on for some time. And finally, he said, Duncan, I'm desperate. He said, I've got 7 arrangements to finish for next week. And I thought, oh. I said, oh, okay. And so John does his own copying, which is incredible.
Oh, my God.
I mean, he's so fast. He's so facile. And he just writes on it and writes very clear, you know. My copying is really abominable. It's like a caveman's drawing, you know. And so I sat up all night, I did this arrangement, I copied it as well, and this terrible schoolboy, and I thought, right, that's it, fine. And it so happened on the Monday, I was talking to Richard Rodney Bennett. Do you know Richard?
No, I don't.
Well, he's Sir Richard Rodney Bennett, and he's a very famous classical composer. But he's really interested in songs, and he's doing a thing at the Oak Room with an English singer called Claire Martin, and Richard really loves to sing. I mean, he really loves, he's fascinated by performing, and he's fascinated by songs. And anyway, Richard said to me, are you doing anything Monday? I said, no, Monday evening. He said, great, so come along to Rainbow and Stars, it's called, in New York. Rainbow, I think it's Rainbow and Stars. It's a huge penthouse place with glass windows and all the rest. He said, I'm doing a coast-to-coast broadcast. And he said, I'm doing I Told You So on it. And I said, Richard, that's really great. I said, but don't do it because I'm here. He said, no, I like the song, I'm doing it. He said, nothing to do with you. He said, but I'd like you to be there. And it was funny because I turned up and I guess we have Richard Roney Bennett. Now, Richard, you've written concertos and ballets and operas and what are you going to do tonight? And Richard said, well, it's a friend of mine who's in the audience, as a matter of fact, Duncan Lamont, he's written a song called I Told You So. And that was a song that Cleo was recording. So anyway, on the Monday afternoon, I went up to hear the session. They were doing mine on the Tuesday. And John's manager said, have you talked to John? I said, no. He said, he wants to see you. And John was playing in the orchestra, you see. So he came out and he was green with fatigue, you know. And he said, Duncan, can you do another arrangement for tomorrow? I said, oh, John. He said, look, I'm really desperate. He said, I mean, why didn't book New York arrangers do it? I don't know, because it was CBS. It was a big deal, you know. And I said, John, John, apart from that, I'm out till about midnight tonight. I'm going to see Richard Rodney Bennett. He said, I'll be up all night. So just come around any time at all. So I turned up at his apartment, their apartment, and he said, this is a song, and he's all sort of, he's nervous because he's got about three arrangements to do for the next day. And I said, oh. I said, well, how about if I do a, and he said, that's fine. That's great, Duncan, yeah, goodbye. There'll be a copyist waiting for you at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I thought, well, at least I have a copy. So I stayed up all night, did the arrangement, and it turned up the next day, and I hadn't been asleep at all. And it was the evening session. I always remember because there was a great pianist called Mike Renzi. He was like the prince of the accompanists in New York. And I'd never met Mike before, but he was a very, very excitable guy. Wonderful player. And I remember they passed my music out, my copy, and there was no Scotch tape. So everybody had individual
single pages.
So I was going around before the, with all these great players, I'm saying, any Scotch tape? Yeah, I'll get. And I was sticking it, you know. I said, excuse me, you know, to flute player and things like that, and stick. And it stuck.
Oh,
up.
You're kidding.
Yeah, it was incredible. And I said to Mike, it's Colabocci, the first part. It clears things out of tempo. Then comes in change of key here, and then it goes out of tempo at the end, and that's it, yeah. So Mike, you're so relaxed with it. Yeah, okay, fine. So we did the recording, and that's it. I thought, well, I don't care. I'm so tired. I don't care. They can do anything like. So I went to walk into the box, and the A&R man, who was the conductor, he was a proper conductor, conducts operas and things like that, a guy called Ettore Strata, said, Duncan, conduct it. I said, I can't conduct. He said, it's your arrangement, conduct it. I thought, I don't believe this. So I'm standing in front of all these guys, and I said, well, I'll do it till the right one comes along. And we started it, and I went through it, just waving my hands about, and at the end of it, there was this ominous silence, and the boy said, I think you better come in. Now, that is usually trouble when they say that, because they don't want to embarrass the guy, you know, through the intercom. So I walked in, this guy, he's quite abrupt. He said, who wrote this song? And I said, well, I did. He said, and did you write the lyric? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, can I publish it? And so I went from the depths of despair to, oh, you like it. And as I was walking, that was the thing that encouraged me, because as I was walking, Mike Renzi said to me, that song, he said, I had terrible trouble playing it. I said, oh, was the copying bad, Mike? I saw a copy. He said, no, I had terrible trouble, because he said, I almost burst into tears playing it.
Aww.
And I said, what do you mean you like it? He said, yeah, it's great, great song. So, I mean, I felt a little fortified. I thought, maybe the guy's wrong, he's going to tell me off. And Ettore said, play it. And the guys came in, and we played it once, and he said, that's it, that's the definitive recording. He said, no more, and the guys applauded.
Oh, my God.
And he said, no, regarding the publishing, and John said, wait a minute, he said, I've already been in touch with my British publisher.
This is John talking.
Yeah, he said, I've emailed him and told him about the song, and suddenly it was a big deal. I was sad about it.
Now they're competing, right?
I was sad. this is good, yeah, I like it. I like being a successful songwriter. And it won the best song of its type of the year in the States.
Wow.
Yeah. But I didn't find out about it till months and months afterwards, because they gave a plaque or something, a cup or something, to Cleo at the Blue Note. She was working at Blue Note. And the A&R guy went down to Tennessee, whatever it was, Nashville, mm-hmm. and collected the award. I didn't know about it for months and months. And all I did was write the song, write the lyric, do the arrangement, conduct it.
That's all you did, right?
I didn't know about it. But I mean, as a matter of fact, Sammy Cohen wrote an article about the song. He said, it pleases me greatly that people are still writing songs like I Told You So. So really, that's the only thing I have any sort of confidence in, because sometimes I play and it's terrible. I consider it terrible. Other times I write things and think, that's not very good. But I mean, I know I've written two or three good songs, and that's the only thing I have any confidence in, you know.
My God.
Because it's got nothing to do with actually performing or whatever. They're actually written and
They're concrete.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, the lyric means something, and I like the tune. And so, I mean, if Stephen Sondheim said, you know, I don't like it, I'd probably say, well, I like it.
So, I imagine that you're curious about this song, I Told You So, that Natalie Cole recorded, that Cleo Lane recorded, that won the Best Song of the Year in America, that Sammy Cohen wrote an article about, in which he said he's happy to know that songs like I Told You So are still being written. I know I was dying of curiosity, because I have to admit that I hadn't heard the song. So I was lucky enough to find Natalie Cole's version of it, and I'm going to play it now for you, and then we'll go back to the interview. So here's Natalie Cole singing I Told You So.
I heard it on the grapevine, straight from the horse's mouth. They're saying on the grapevine that he heading north and you're going south. I hate to say it, but I told you so before the curtain fell. I told you so. I've known for a long time it couldn't last. Now you're just a memory in his long and distant past. How can you tell someone who is starry-eyed? Her Dr. Jekyll's really Mr. Hyde. I know, I've seen it all before. I loved him once, but that was long ago. I warn you. hoped I wouldn't have to say that I told you so. But he's losing interest, and you feel like a bore. Then one day you wake inside to hear a closing door. How can you tell someone who is mystified that vintage champagne's really cyanide? I know I've seen it all before. I loved him once, but now the scars don't show.
There you have it, the song that made the piano player cry and that convinced Duncan Lamont, the legendary saxophone player, that really what he wanted to do was write songs. And before I pick the interview back up, I'm going to play another single song of Duncan's so you can see his versatility. This song is called Fred Astaire. It's an homage to the glorious dancer, performer, Fred Astaire, and it was recorded by Blossom Dearie, the legendary Blossom Dearie. It's a perfect song for her. And as soon as the cut is done, I'm going to pick the interview back up.
There's only one person I know who seems to dance on air. You won't be surprised when I say his name is Fred Astaire. There's nobody else who can emulate that special flair. Why, even the way that he walks, you'd know him anywhere. I declare, he's quite rare. Nobody else in this world who's quite like Fred Astaire. He even looks good when you see him dancing with a chair. Oh, those feet, what a pair. Yeah, Fred Astaire. Yeah,
songwriting is really, really the thing that interests me. But I mean, playing is a sort of passion that I do. I wouldn't do it all the time if I didn't feel the need to, you know.
Yes.
But I mean, usually it's a question of, oh, I should use another reed, I should use another mouthpiece, and, you know, my fingers aren't working or whatever. But I mean, people seem to like the way I play around here.
So. Yes, they do.
So that's yeah.
I can speak to that.
So that's my story.
Oh my God, it's an amazing story. It is absolutely an amazing
story.
Yes, it is absolutely amazing. Well, you know it is. I don't know.
I don't think.
Oh, well, then you'll just have to take my word for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's this. It's like you got on a. I mean, from the time you learned The Merry Widow, you simply never turned back, you know?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And people kept saying to you, do this, do this, do this, do this, and you kept saying, well, all right, well, all right, well, all right. And
yeah,
when, you know,
that's right.
Well, I don't know how, and I don't think I can, but okay, okay. You know?
Yeah, because there was one time I was in L.A., in New York, and I was doing some lyrics for Johnny Mandel.
Mm.
You know Johnny Roy?
I do.
Shadow of Your Smile, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Emily. And it was through...
Suicide is Painless.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through Nancy Marano, a singer in New York who recorded a CD of songs of mine. And Nancy phoned me, she said, this song that Johnny wrote called Seascape. And I think it'd be nice if you wrote a lyric for it. So I said, well, I don't mind, but how would Johnny feel about it? I knew Johnny and he knew me. Because we were on a broadcast over here from Chicago, this guy knew about me as a songwriter, as an arranger, etc., and naturally knew about Johnny, and he got both of us on the station, and we talked. So I mean, Johnny knew something about me anyway, and so she said, "Well, give Johnny a ring." So I phoned. Oh, no, she phoned Johnny. And Johnny said, yeah, let Duncan do the lyric. So, I mean, he's so painstaking. Everything is... He takes ages to write an arrangement. He takes ages to write a song. But once they're written, they're really little classics. You know, he's really... He's special. Johnny Mandel is really special. But anyway, I wrote a lyric and I sent it to Johnny. And he phoned me and said... He said, no, Duncan, that isn't the sort of lyric I wanted. He said, I want it about the sea. I said, what, you want something like a William Blake poem? He said, no, about the turmoil and the various moods of the sea and thing and connected with life. And I said, well, I'll try. He said, well, when are you coming to New York? I said, well, I'll be there in a couple of weeks. He said, well, so will I. He said, give me a ring. He said, and I'll come round to your hotel. And so anyway, I was in New York and I phoned Johnny. He said, I'll be right round. And Johnny came in and the first thing he did was, I mean, do you know Johnny Mandel?
I don't.
Well, he's a wonderful character. He's incredible. He's quite eccentric. The first thing he did was take his shoes off and lie in the bed and start expounding about things with his hands. His arms behind his
head. He made himself comfortable.
Yeah, and he was talking about other things. And finally he said, let me see the lyrics. Have you written any other lyrics? I said, yeah, I've written two or three. So he got up, he looked at him and went, no. He said, Duncan, we have to get round a piano sometime, you and I. And I said, yeah, fine. And he said, you know, Duncan, you have a wonderful future ahead of you. I said, what, it's 65, which I was at the time. It seems young now, but I mean, he said, do you know why? I said, no, why? He said, because, he said, you don't care.
That's right.
He said, you don't care if people record your songs. And I said, well, there's a universe of songs, Johnny. I mean, I'm always happy if somebody records one of mine, but yeah, I don't really mind if people don't. And actually, a couple of singers have said that to me. They said, it's good with you because you never bother whether we record your songs or not. Other songwriters give them a hard time, you know,
yeah.
Really. Quite, why didn't you record my song? That's a great song, you know. They said, but you never bother us at all. So I said to him, but you don't mind, do you, Johnny? Because you're so dreamy. He said, yeah, of course I do. I want people to record my songs. He said, you know something, Duncan? He said, I've always searched for the brass ring. Is that what it's called, the brass ring?
Yes, it is.
And he said, I've always searched throughout my life. He said, but you know, the truth of the matter is, there isn't a brass ring. And I said, well, I don't know. So Johnny and I are very good friends. And the other, because he said to me, oh yeah, we must get together. He said, come down on Thursday, because he was doing a CD with Dave Sanborn with strings. And he said, well, they'll be mixing, so come, we'll get around the piano. So he phoned me, he said, have you written any other lyrics? I said, Johnny, I've written everything from bebop to polkas. I said, yeah, I've written loads of lyrics. I've written about 30 lyrics. And I went down to the studio and Johnny went to the piano and he played the first one, singing it, and no. Next one. And he went through nearly all of them, and he came to one and he said, hey, I really like this lyric. This is good, Duncan. Yeah, I like it. And I said, do you? He said, well, don't you? I said, no, I don't know, actually. I said, I'm written out, Johnny. He said, I like this, yes. All it needs is a dynamite ending. He said, when are you going to Florida? I said, Sunday. He said, yeah, I'm going away on Sunday too. He said, all we need is a dynamite ending for it. He said, and he said, I really like it. I said, well, great, I'm right. I'll try. He said, well, you'd be near the water anyway. It's great for you, Duncan. So anyway, Johnny and I left, and I started writing dynamite endings to send them to Johnny. And anyway, before I was going to back to New York after I left Sarasota, and I phoned Johnny and spoke to his daughter, and she said, oh, Dad's out at the moment. But when are you going back to New York? I said, next week. Well, my dad will be there next week. I said, oh, that's great. And so when I get back up to New York, I phoned Johnny at his hotel. I said, what do you think of the endings? And Johnny started waffling around. He said, oh, Duncan, they're really nice, really poetic and you know, nice imagery. And finally I said, Johnny, do you like it? I said, you sound as though you're going around the house. I said, because to be quite frank, I don't really like the lyric very much. And he said, well, I still think it needs an ending. And I said, well, Johnny, why didn't you get somebody else to write the lyric? I said, I don't really mind. I said, I mean, that's the whole thing. I said, I want you to be happy. I said, get the Bergmans to write a lyric. He said, oh, no, they're too busy with Barbara Streisand. I said, well, get somebody else to write a lyric. He said, well, I might get Lieber and Stoller. I mean, he's talking about really big people.
I know.
And he said, I might give it to him. I said, Mike Stoller. He said, I might give it to Mike Stoller. I said, Johnny, give it to whoever you like. I said, I don't really like the lyric all that much. He said, well, you might get a brainwave. I said, Johnny, I promise you, I want a brainwave. I said, no. I said, I'm written out. I said, I won't write another word for that lyric. And the funny part is, he's so dreamy that I spoke to Nancy, that was 15 years ago or whatever, and Nancy Morana, and she said, Duncan, maybe I shouldn't tell you this, but she said, I was talking to Johnny Mandel recently, and I said to Johnny, did you ever get a lyric for Seascape? And he said, well, as a matter of fact, Arthur Hamilton, the guy who wrote Cry Me a River,
I know,
is writing a lyric at the moment. He said, so hopefully I'll have a lyric soon. It's like 15 years later.
He still doesn't have one.
And yeah. And Nancy said, but what about the lyrics that Duncan wrote? She said, there was one that Blossom liked and I liked very much. And she said, maybe I shouldn't tell you, but Johnny said, Duncan didn't write any lyrics. She said, Johnny, Duncan wrote 30 lyrics. He said, no, he didn't. And she said, maybe I shouldn't tell. I said, I love Johnny Mandel. Because he's so big. He's so, I mean, it didn't bother me at all, actually. But, just great. But I mean, it seems to be my life has been... You're right. I never thought about it, but it's a question of people ask me to do things, and I guess my better judgment, I think, oh well, I suppose I better do it.
Yes.
You know, or other times, I mean, with Mr. Ben, for instance, I didn't even think I couldn't do it. It was just so casual. Right. I thought I'd be shown about three times. I mean, I think
it's both. I mean, it's was it Johnny Keating who had to beat you up into going into that first band?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, you know, I mean, so there's these people who are presenting you with things which you don't think you can do and which you have apprehension about, and
yeah.
But then you are forced somehow to do them.
Yeah.
And then there are these other things which are so casual, you know, you don't think much of them.
Yeah.
But it's all the same. It's all stuff coming at you.
Yeah,
you
that's
know?
Right. Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
It's really wonderful.
Yeah,
it's wonderful. It's
Oh, that's nice. Nice you said that. I never thought about it before. I never. But I mean, with Johnny, it's still the same. Johnny is, you know, if he is anything at all, I'm the player he's in love with. He really, really does. Love the way that I play, you know. And the same thing happened with a wonderful writer called Jeremy Lubbock. I don't know if you know Jeremy, but uh-huh. Jeremy, he lives in LA now, and he's written for everyone, Streisand, you name it, he's written for everybody. Well, it was same with Jeremy. He used to play the piano at one time in this really lovely place called Esmeralda's Barn in Knightsbridge. And Jeremy is very imperious. He really is a lovely guy, but he's frightfully, frightfully British, and he's very imperious. And he played everything in, I think it was E and B or something, which are nightmare keys for people, because they never play in those keys. And Jeremy knew a host of tunes, little-known tunes, Rodgers and Hart, little-known Rodgers and Hart, Hard Island or whatever. And I remember the first time I went up, people said, you can go and sit in. So I went up to this lovely, lovely club. And I remember there was about four or five people on the stand, and Jeremy was sitting in. And it was like the First World War, it was like people in the trenches, because they only last a minute. They just disappeared. I mean, they just didn't even try and play. And I went up and I said, "Can I play a tune?" And Jeremy said, "Yeah. Do you know 'Glad to Be Unhappy'?"
And it's I a said, great tune.
"Yeah." And he said, "Do you know the verse?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well," and he just he didn't
what is this
mention.
A trick?
Yeah, he just didn't even mention what key, but he started an E or something. And I played, and it was like Johnny Keating. He fell in love with the way I played.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, I mean, after that, I could do no wrong. It's like Johnny, which I still can't understand. But I mean, I'm not being overly modest, but I just can't understand it. But I mean, Jeremy has worked with everybody, including Stan Getz. He did a lovely double CD with Dan Shure, with Johnny Mandel. And Johnny loves his writing, because Johnny said to me, he said, if you're doing string arrangements with Jeremy Lubbock, he said, you'd come out badly bruised. He said, I mean, Jeremy is so wonderful, you know. And Jeremy said to me, you know, he said, I talk a lot, he talked a lot to Stan Getz about you. He said, we talked about you a lot. I mean, and that was recently, and it's really nice to think that, I mean, these people are supremely talented. And to think that I've made an impression on them is a wonderful feeling, you know, it's really. So it is a question of actually, maybe I've got an inferiority complex. I probably have, actually.
Actually, I think it's something else. I think it's that, it's something that you were saying earlier about having been so loved as a child, is that you just don't need it that bad.
Well, maybe it is that, but
do you understand what I mean? I mean, people feel you're not working at it. Do you know what I mean?
I'm definitely not working at it.
No, and so you leave people free to love you. You're
to
not asking for it. Well, but you're not asking for it.
Yeah.
You know, and it, there's something ironic about, you know, the more people ask for it, the less they get it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah.
And you don't have to because you've got that.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it goes back to the shipyards. Maybe I think, well, nothing can
be worse than this.
I mean, I've said that to people. I said, you know, it's a wonderful thing for a young person to... I was in the shipyards from a school team. It's a wonderful thing for a young person to start out in the shipyards because once you leave, everything improves.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to... You might be doing a terrible gig or something that's really...
But you know.
Dramatic, but you think, I could be in the shipyards. So... Yeah. But it's funny talking about one's life. I mean, you actually don't think about it until you have to talk about
it.
No,
I think that's right. I generally ask people when they're winding down if there's anything you want to say about what it means to have lived a life entirely devoted to your art.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all I can say is it's been... It's quite spiritual in a way. I mean, it's quite magical and spiritual.
I think those are two extremely good words to describe your life.
I can't imagine doing anything else. I mean, I seem to have stumbled through my life in a way. Stumbled through it. And luckily enough, I must have had something that appealed to people, which is marvelous. But I mean, I think that music is, I can only put it down to spiritual because there's some undefinable thing about it that attracts people. I mean, non-musicians. Everyone is fascinated by music, aren't they?
Yeah, everybody is drawn in.
They're drawn in. It's a wonderful thing. And it's wonderful to write a song. I mean, rather than to be a player and play and maybe move. It might be just the musicians on the stand or the singer on the stand. It's really nice feeling because often people miss nuances, maybe. But that's a nice feeling. But it's a great feeling to write a song that really seems to move people.
Yes.
And some of the statements I've had from people who've been moved by a particular song of mine is probably the best feeling in the world, you know. So really, I think I'm a songwriter who dabbles at music, I suppose, really. But I mean, it is really, really wonderful. I've been very, very, very blessed. It's been hard work. It's been, I mean, I've worked hard.
Yes, you have.
But I mean, it's been spiritual is the only word. I can keep using that word because it just seems to sum the whole thing up, you know.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think it's a perfect place to end this.
Magical and spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Duncan.
You're welcome, my darling. You're welcome.
Magical and spiritual. And that is what Duncan Lamont certainly is. Magical and spiritual. Again, I hope that you enjoyed listening to this interview just a tiny bit as much as I enjoyed doing it. So a big thank you to Duncan Lamont for all of his incredible generosity and his wonderful music. Well, closing in on the end of this show, I get to tell you that if you want to get in touch with me, you want to find out anything about me, you can go up on my website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out because You'll get a different Lynn. TheLynnShow.com. Before I close the show, as I always do, I want to thank the intrepid Josh Hackney, without whom there would be no show. So, and say again that if you have needs for anything having to do with recording, with electronics, with computers, with the internet, anything that you need help with, support for, you want Josh Hackney, and you can get him by going up on my website and saying, I need Josh, and I will get him for you. And as always, I hope that you heard something in this show that you can use, something that amused you, entertained you, was spiritual and magical for you. Anyway, something that brings you back, because same time next week, same station, I will be here, and boy, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So